Pamela Berger is professor of fine arts, professor in the fine arts department here at Boston College, and where she teaches medieval art, focusing on the period from 300 to 1425 CE. Her special interest is iconography, namely the meaning of the image in the context of its time, and most of her research deals with iconographic interpretation. In addition to her more traditional professorial role, Professor Berger is a filmmaker who has written, produced, and or directed three feature films. Sorceress is about a medieval woman accused of being a heretic, but actually a healer, shot in both French and English. DVDs are available. The second film, which she wrote, produced, and directed, is The Imported Bridegroom, a comedy set in Boston in 1900 about a father who tries to find in the old country the perfect bridegroom for his Americanized daughter. That's also on DVD. And the third film, Killian's Chronicle, The Magic Stone, is about an Irish slave who escapes from a Viking ship and is rescued by Native Americans 500 years before the arrival of Columbus. So we have a multi-talented and very interesting speaker today, and it's really our pleasure to have you speak to us today about the Dome of the Rock and the Temple of Solomon.
Thank you, Eric. I want to thank the Boise Institute for providing me with this opportunity to go over some of this research that I had been doing last year during my sabbatical. So I've been working on, I came across this strange phenomenon, a seeing in the middle of the Middle Ages of these circular temples, which were supposed to represent the temple in which Jesus was presented for his presentation in the temple, in which Jesus was circumcised, and even in which Mary was announced, and temples in which Mary was confronted by Gabriel announcing the impending birth of Jesus. All of these New Testament scenes were shown not in the temple that one would expect, for instance, either an oblong temple, which represented the temple that Solomon created, or the oblong temple that was the temple of Herod, which replaced it, which would have been the actual temple that Jesus, for instance, would have chased the merchants out of the courtyard from, but a circular temple. And as I began to study the material, I came to understand why, and that's what I'm going to explicate for you today. So, in 586 BCE, the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, as you know, destroyed the Temple of Solomon, which he had erected on a place that, you know, David had selected or purchased or prayed at least, in the text. Well, that temple, the Jews came back in 459 and they began to reconstruct some temple, the Zerubbabel temple, but we don't know very much about that. Haggai has some references to it, but we don't know much about it. But there are scholars who believe that the temple of Herod, in fact, was built more or less on the plan that the Zerubbabel temple was built on, which again would have had an oblong or rectilinear plan. Now, that temple was destroyed in 70 AD, but there were people who remembered what it looked like, and after the Bar Kokhba rebellion in 135, there were coins that were produced which had the facade of that temple. So we have that little bit of archaeological information. There's been no digging done there, as you probably know. But there are descriptions. We know some things about it. We certainly know that the Holy of Holies was somewhere inside. Well, actually, I'm going to get my pointer so that I can show you some of the details here. We know that the Holy of Holies was somewhere inside, represented in a special chamber. And here we have the Holy of Holies. This particular representation of it has four columns that are portrayed there. And that's one sort of archaeological piece of evidence that we have. Now, the mural in Dura Europus, which is a town that was destroyed in the middle of the third century Common Era, But has a lot, we're doing a show on it in BC actually in a year, so I'm telling you about it. It has a Mithraeum, it has a Zoroastrian sanctuary, it has a Mithraeum, it has a Roman god sanctuary, and it also has a temple, which was frescoed. And one of the frescoes is this particular mural, which does have in it an image of what people may have thought the Temple of Herod looked like, even though this is not supposed to be the scene of that Temple of Herod. It's supposed to be a scene from Leviticus, the beginning of Leviticus, where Aaron is told to gather animals for a sacrifice in the tabernacle in the desert. However, in art, they often make syncretized forms, and the tabernacle in the desert became what they saw as the temple. This may have been something like what the temple was like. In other words, a kind of Roman temple with columns and a cella, a holy of holies way inside, etc., etc. So this gives us some general idea of what they thought the temple was like. Now, even though the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed, the place where it was continue to be revered. The Jews were expelled absolutely from Jerusalem after, first in 70 Common Era, and then again in the Bar Kokhba revolt. The Romans absolutely expelled the Jews, and the Christians, the Constantine, continued that expulsion. They were not allowed to come in on penalty of death. They lived in the surrounding areas, but they did not come up to Jerusalem. However, there were groups of Jews who did come there, and I'll talk about them later. And in the Talmudic tradition, they came up there, and they came up there because the site was marked for them by a rock that they felt was had something to do with the Holy of Holies, that the Ark may have been on, and I'll quote some of that for you later. In the Talmudic tradition, in the Babylonian Talmud, I have it on the screen, quote, "When the Ark had been taken away, it was observed that there was a stone from the time of the first prophets," Shetiyah, in foundation it means in Hebrew, it was called, "and it was three fingers above the ground. Thereupon the priest placed the censer," we're not sure what the word exactly is there. Then in the Mishnah, "a stone," Shetiyah, "we have learned that the word Shetiyah means that the universe has been created from it, as Shetiyah means foundation." So in the Mishnah and in the Talmud, there are these references to a stone, a foundation stone. It says elsewhere in the Talmud, "When the Ark had been taken away, it was observed that there was a stone from the time of the first prophets," Shetiyah, "foundation," it was called. At some point, this foundation stone got linked to a text in Isaiah, quote, "So has the Lord God said, behold, I have laid as a foundation stone in Zion, a fortress stone, a costly cornerstone, a foundation." It keeps it in the Isaiah text. It was there, so they kept on repeating and using this language. Ezekiel. It became linked also, this special stone became linked with the middle of the earth. The stone in the Isaiah verse came to be known also as the Shetiyah, the Eben HaShetiyah, and it was discussed as being the most holy part of the temple. So, this holy stone, or place, site, that's been identified in the Talmud, that's been linked with the prophets, evidently was a place that the Jews continued to go to and continued to have some kind of a ceremonial around, furtively, because we have a pilgrim who came from Bordeaux, France, in 333. And he, as a Christian, goes around, views things, and then he goes up. And he sees that on this Temple Mount, there was, he noticed, a pierced stone, which Jews come to every year and anoint. And they mourn, and they rend their garments. Okay? So we have to picture Jews on penalty of death, because they were not allowed in the city under Constantine 333. And they come up there, in some way they anoint it, in some way they rend their garments, and they mourn there. Years later, Jerome, later sainted, comes, he's also there for a good deal of time, we know he learns Hebrew, etc. He noticed up there, quote, woe begone women, and old men, their congregants, he calls them miserable people who groan over the ruins of their temple. A soldier asks money to allow them to weep a little longer. And there's indication here that when they go, it's the morning day of Tisha B'Av, which is the day on which Jews traditionally mourn the destruction of the temple. Now, I'm not going to talk about all the legends, but there are numerous, numerous legends that likewise connect this stone with Abraham and Isaac, with potentially where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac. Jacob's pillow, and then the tablets of Moses' Ten Commandments. Now, in the Muslim tradition, there is also a link with this stone in this early period. Rock as the navel of the world, sweet water coming from beneath it. It's associated in Muslim tradition with the dreams of Jacob. And also, Ishmael was almost sacrificed on that stone in the legends. And the ram's horn will be blown on that stone on the day of resurrection. So, as one scholar, Hirschberg, has said, for the Muslims, the rock was to become the last remaining vestige of the Holy of Holies of the ruined temple. So Muslims took over the rabbinic and the prophetic traditions as to why the temple had been destroyed also. Now, in the prophetic traditions, the temple, as Jeremiah says, it was a punishment for the kings who had shed blood and for the people who had slain prophets. That was why the temple was destroyed, according to this prophetic tradition. Now, Muslim writings followed the Jewish tradition also in connecting David to this rock. We know that David is connected to it because in the Hebrew Bible, in these citations here, David prayed there when the first baby that he had with Bathsheba that was the baby that he had with her after having had her husband Uriah placed in the front lines and killed and so on, etc. So it was a grave sin. And the baby was born sick. And David went to a spot and he prayed to God not to let the baby die, but the baby died. But that became a spot where David prayed. Another time, David took a census, which just seems innocuous, but God said, people belong to me. You are not allowed to count the people. They do not belong to you. Therefore, I will punish you with either war or famine or plague. David chose plague. So the angel of death came along, and it went through the land, and it killed a lot of people. But it came to Jerusalem, toward Jerusalem, and David wanted to prevent Jerusalem from being, from the people of Jerusalem from being killed by the plague. So he prayed, and the spot where he prayed was again this holy spot where David prayed. Now, the Quran also has this idea that there was a spot where David prayed. David, and I'm quoting the Quran here, sought forgiveness, and he bowed himself and fell down prostrate, and we forgave him. So there was this spot again where David prayed. Now, when after Muhammad has died, and we have the second caliph Umar, who was the armies of the Muslim forces had already conquered places in Damascus and places even farther to the east in present day Iraq, etc. He came toward Jerusalem, but I'm taking texts here that are later, that are 10th century by Muther al-Ghiram, who talk about and who have sources that are earlier, and they're basing their work on earlier texts, but that talk about what happened with Umar as he came toward Jerusalem. Umar did not want to destroy Jerusalem. Umar wanted to have a peaceful entry into the city. At that time, the Byzantine armies, in 636, the Byzantine armies were in charge of Jerusalem, but as they when they learned that Umar was coming with his forces, they fled. So the nominal head of the city, Christian city at this time, Jerusalem, was Sophronius, Bishop Sophronius. He also, of course, didn't want his population to be destroyed, and the army had fled. And there are a whole lot of stories about how Sophronius and Umar made a pact, a treaty, a plan. And it's called the Treaty of Umar, according to which Umar would come in peacefully into the city. The Christians would be allowed to stay there, but they could not build churches that were higher than mosques. They could not ride camels that were higher than the camels that the Muslims rode on, a whole series of things, including that the Christians would have to pay an extra tax because they could not go into the army, and therefore they had to support the army, and they would pay an extra tax. So they're just some of the things in this special treaty of Umar. So there are stories of how Umar and Sophronius came together into Jerusalem. Now, Umar was accompanied by Ka'b al-Akbar, who was an old Jew. He was probably in his 70s or 80s at the time. The 70s are not so old, but he was older. he was we'll call him a young Jew. he had converted to, at that time, it wasn't like a conversion case. He was a Jew who knew the Talmud, he knew the Bible, he knew, all Jewish lore and history, and he accepted Muhammad as the final prophet. So there wasn't this differentiation in his mind at that time from what we can gather from the text. Okay, so he is accompanying Umar and probably was the one who told Umar a great deal about the places in Jerusalem. We know he told him a great deal about places in Jerusalem. And Umar, for his own reasons, which I won't go into, was very interested in finding the place where David prayed. He may have himself, in his earlier life, before Muhammad came, before he became a Muslim, he may have been involved in a child sacrifice, which is in a Shiite text, and most Sunnis don't accept it, and I don't want to get into that, but he may himself have wanted to seek forgiveness for something that he had done to cause the death of a child, okay? Anyway, so they march through the city, and Sophronius actually tries to fool Umar, because Umar from the beginning says, I want to go to the place where David prayed. So Sophronius takes him, according to some accounts, first to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And Umar won't even put a footstep on that church because he says, if I go here, maybe this will become, for my followers, a holy place, and I don't want to deal with that. So finally Sophronius says, okay, I will take you to the actual place where David prayed. Now, this place had become a garbage dump. In actually the literal what we hear from the texts, in the sense that Hadrian had probably built some temples there to Venus, to Jupiter, we're not sure, but even the Hadrianic temples had fallen. The Christians certainly were not going to resurrect pagan temples, and so the stones had all fallen down, and it was a garbage dump in the sense of all everything was demolished. But the texts want to emphasize that, so they have this trope. It had become so defiled that women threw their menstrual cloths there. That's not true. But that was the way to show how a site that had been a holy site to another people had been completely defiled. And we have things like that in North Africa where they say, and donkeys drop their droppings there, so that it's completely desanctified. Okay, so they went around to where the gates were, and Umar and his soldiers had to pull rocks out of the gate, the south gate. As they pulled the rocks out, things would fall, but anyway, they got up there, and there were all these stones from the demolished buildings. But Ka'b knew the measurements in the Mishnah of how to find the site where the temple had been. And so he said such and such number of cubits from the well to the east, and such a number of cubits from the place to the west, and then one way or another, they found an area which was all covered with stones. But according to another text, they started to take off the stones, and Umar himself placed some of the stones into his cloak and threw them into the wadi on the east side of the mound that they were. eventually they did find this rock, which of course Cobb felt was the place, because he knew the Mishnah and the Gemara, and he knew where David had prayed. Now, a generation or so later, Al-Malik built this shrine over that spot. In the intervening time, when Umar came in, one of the things that he required of Sophronius was that they let the Jews come back into Jerusalem. So Jews came from Safed, several families came. We know that they came and they lived on the south slope. That's what the text tells us. Actually, the Cairo Geniza tells a certain amount. The text there tells a certain amount about what happened with these people. So there were Jews who came back in. And they were, I'll read you some of the material a little bit later about how overjoyed they were to be again allowed into Jerusalem. So that's the climate of the time. And on that place where the rock had been revealed, this place that Umar had thought was special and sacred, and that Cobb had knew was special and sacred, and now that these Jews had come back, on that site was where Amalek built the Dome of the Rock. Okay? That was the spot that they built it. Now, there are scholars, who Busi is one of them, who examine the ritual that went on in the Dome of the Rock as soon as it was built. Right away, it was built in 691. Oh, yes. Okay, so they, apparently, the rituals in the Dome of the Rock and were on Mondays and Thursdays. Those are the days that are fasting days for the very religious Jews in the temple or were at this time. Another thing, there were certain kinds of ablutions that he's examined, which were also the kinds of ablutions that he's found were those practiced around the temple as related in the Mishnah, or the Gemara. The tunics that they wore, the special names for the tunics, the purple, the violet, the red, the colors on the tunics, apparently also were common. The aromatic mixtures of spices soaked in musk and ambergris and rose water that they used to anoint the rock were apparently similar. And the Pilgrim of Bordeaux, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, also talks about anointing the rock, Jews continuing on pain of death to come and anoint the rock. Now, the incense also that were part of the ritual in the Dome of the Rock, apparently that was part of what was going on in the Temple of Herod also, because Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, when it was announced, he was a priest in the temple, when it was announced to him by Gabriel that he was going to have a child, he was in the process, as a priest, of moving incense around inside the Holy of Holies in the temple. Okay, so that's from the New Testament source. Now, there was, and I have lots of other texts that show this attitude toward the Dome of the Rock on the part of the Jews, that it was somehow, it wasn't the temple again, but it was a holy site, it was somehow linked with their holy site, and that they may have even been involved in, you know, helping to, not construct it, but, well, who knows, that they would certainly would have been happy about that. And we know, because there's a Secrets of Rabbi Simon Bar Yochai, an 8th century, 9th century source, which is actually studied by Bernard Lewis. And the analysis of this text will show you something of the attitude of the Jews of a couple of generations after the Dome of the Rock was built, about this Dome of the Rock. He says, God will send to the Ishmaelites a prophet in accordance with his will, and he will conquer the land for them. And the second king that will rule from Ishmael will be a lover of Israel, and he will bend their breaches and the breaches of the temple, and he will dig Mount Moriah and level the whole of its surface, and he will build a place of worship, and on the foundation rock, Eben Hashetiah, again, on the foundation rock, this person who lived after the building, but he places his text before, as if we were making a film of 1,000 years ago, and projecting into the future that this will happen, that an Ishmaelite king will come and build this rock. Friendly, he is friendly to the Jews. The inscriptions on the interior of the Dome of the Rock, also, there are many of them, the ones that have been looked at from the time of Al-Malik, are also, they testify to the common Jewish-Muslim belief in one God. Do not say three, desist, it is better for you, for indeed God is one. God does not beget, nor God has God begotten. And they attack the Trinitarian sources. Now, before the Crusades, we have imagery that shows us that, in fact, the Dome of the Rock was seen as the temple in which Jesus walked, shall we say, even before the Crusades. And there are pilgrims, whose text I'm not quoting, who go to Jerusalem, see the Dome of the Rock, and somehow conflate it with the temple that Jesus walked in. You know, so here's one from the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. Now here you see Zacharias, and here's the angel. Zacharias has a censer there; he's incensing here. And the this is in art history. They have, in medieval art history, there are shortcuts one takes. There are abbreviations. They don't show the actual building. But here, what they show us is a dome that is gold, and we know that the Dome of the Rock was gilded from early on, at the beginning, and that there are the ribs that were there at the Dome of the Rock, and there are even these windows that were there. We don't have the part that comes out over the ambulatories, but in medieval art, that is common that you wouldn't have the whole thing. Now, when the Crusaders came in, actually a last stand of the Muslims and the Jews, in fact, there in the city, and even the Christians, who the Crusaders didn't know were Christian because they looked like everybody else, and they had the same kind of, they spoke the same language, so they didn't know who was who. Anyway, that's another story. So they came in, there was a last stand in the Dome of the Rock, but when the Christians came in, shortly thereafter, you know, maybe half a generation or a generation thereafter, they actually dedicated the Dome of the Rock as the Templum Domini, the Temple of Our Lord. And somehow, even Fulcher, who's a very good historian, he just merges it with the temple where Jesus walked. It just becomes the same place. And so that circular temple here is shown. This is the Amelie said she was one of the queens living in Jerusalem, and she had this Psalter done for her in the 1130s, and we see evidence here of the presentation of Jesus in the temple. This is Simeon, Joseph, Mary, Joseph with little birds here, and this is the prophetess Anna, and we see that this is all taking place underneath the Dome of the Rock. So that's one example I'm taking from many that I could take. Crusader maps also show, now this is the city of Jerusalem. Here's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, by the way. And this is the Templum Domini, the Temple of Our Lord. And here is that lapis, that pierced stone. There's a lot there are a lot of pilgrims who wanted a piece of that pierced stone on top of which that Dome of the Rock was built. That pierced stone became so valuable to pilgrims that they started knocking off pieces of it, and they went back to the West with these pieces. So in fact, what they did was the Templars must have been, they placed a marble floor over that stone, and you could still see it in some places, but they didn't want people vandalizing the stone because it would all be gone as relics. Okay, so that's your pierced stone right there. And the Dome of the Rock, the Templum Domini, the Temple of Our Lord, is shown right there. Seals, lead seals of the Templars also show the Dome of the Rock, and they call it the Temple of Christ. We have the same dome, we have the ribs, we have the windows. They have a porch here, which was actually on there fairly early. So these seals go all over. Now the Templars actually had one of their main western outposts in Saint-Gilles-du-Gard, which is in the southern part of France. So we know that those seals and what the temple, supposedly temple, looked like, were familiar to at least the people in Saint-Gilles-du-Gard, although other places also. This is a very curious iconography, but I'll tell you about it. This is on the facade here, and we see the crucifixion. A lot of it's damaged, but on this side, we have Mary holding a chalice up to Jesus, taking his blood. Okay, so that is the, I should have said the figure of church, ecclesia. I shouldn't have said Mary. I meant to say ecclesia. She's up there, she's taking his blood in a chalice. So she's there. On the other side, we have this figure of synagogue. This pairing of church and synagogue, ecclesia, synagoga, is very common. We have hundreds of examples in medieval art. So here is synagogue. She's often shown blindfolded, with her staff broken, with her banner falling to the ground. In fact, here, although it's broken, Mackenzie, here's her banner has fallen to the ground. We can't tell what her eyes are, if her eyes are blindfolded. But an angel is pushing her down. Now, the curious thing is that the way she is shown, she's shown with, instead of a crown, it's the, quote-unquote, the synagogue, or the temple, with its dome and the ambulatory. And it's a very clear rendition of the Dome of the Rock, which they conflated with the temple. So you can see here that the Dome of the Rock has become not only the temple in a positive sense, but also here, the temple in a negative sense, because it's used, it's placed on the head of synagogue, who is being destroyed by this angel in retribution for the crucifixion. So it's even more complicated than this, but I don't have time to go into it. Okay, now just to show you some of the prettier examples of where the Dome of the Rock is used as a temple that Jesus walked in, which is called, of course, they keep on calling it the Temple of Solomon, even though it's the Temple of Herod. They call it the Temple of Solomon. And then even though it's now the Dome of the Rock, they still keep on calling it the Temple of Solomon that was transformed into the Temple of Herod. And now it is still thought of as the temple that Jesus walked in. And here is St. James, Jacobus, which is James the Minor, actually. And he is being pushed off the roof. This is in, as you can see, in Venice. He's being, in San Marco, he's being pushed off the roof of the temple. And how is the temple shown? With a dome, with windows, and even here, much more clearly, with an ambulatory going round. So these are the Jews here who have pushed him off. And these are the Pharisees over here in this wonderful mosaic. Now, another example of the temple being used in Christian art, the Dome of the Rock being used in Christian art as the Temple of Solomon. We have a moralized Bible around the 1220s. And the text here is a summary of 3 Kings here. And what it says is that Solomon comes and gives thanks to God and praises Lord God when he has finished the temple. And here is the temple, which has the circuit with the dome and the windows, and there's a ciborium underneath. It's made analogous here to the church, but that's made analogous to the church that Jesus has built. Now, not to be undone, in Muslim art also, in the early 1300s, we have this Al-Biruni text, the chronology of ancient nations, and the text actually deals with Jewish holidays, one of which is actually the Ninth of Ab, the time of the mourning over the temple in Jerusalem. There's a whole expose there. So this is Nebuchadnezzar's dream about Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of the temple, which is, of course, the one in 586 before the Common Era. But they conflate it with the temple of, they conflate it with the temple of the Dome of the Rock. So here you've got Nebuchadnezzar. And there you've got the dome here. And then you've got some inscription here, which tells us the Dome of the Rock has Bayit al-Maqdis, which means the Temple of Solomon, a name also sometimes used for Jerusalem. So in the Muslim world also, the temple that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed in 586 was seen as that same image of the Dome of the Rock. Okay. Now, in the Jewish illustrative tradition, okay, here I'm skipping forward. I'm not going to go through the numerous times in medieval art where you would see this circular temple, the Dome of the Rock, shown in Christian art. There are hundreds of examples. But I'm going to skip to a much more, from medieval art, I think is a more interesting illustrative tradition, where in the Jewish tradition, the Dome of the Rock came to stand for the Temple of Solomon also. Now, this is a similar image in iconographic content to both the image that I showed you in Dura, and also to an image that appears illustrating Leviticus 1 in the Octotope tradition. These traditions of manuscripts in the Byzantine world that were copied probably from Jewish sources in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, according to one scholar, Weitzman. Okay, so this is the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides. The text of Octotope Leviticus 1 is what's being shown here. This, of course, is the scene in Leviticus 1 of the sacrifice. The preparation of the heifer for the sacrifice takes place here. And then, in a typical medieval way, the next thing that happens, the burning of the sacrifice, also takes place within the same frame space. And that takes place in front of the temple tabernacle. And how is it shown? It's shown, and this is because we're already here in the Renaissance, mid to late 15th century, as the Dome of the Rock. So, now, why would the Jews in late 15th century Italy, which is where this was illustrated, use the Dome of the Rock image as the Temple of Solomon, or the Temple of Solomon conflated with the Temple of Herod? Why would they do that? Well, there was a different climate then, apparently, about the notion of what the Dome of the Rock was and what it stood for than there is, for instance, present day. For instance, we have this positive attitude toward the Dome of the Rock reflected in the work and the writings of a Rabbi Petachia. He says, he's talking about the beautiful place where the Ishmaelites built Jerusalem. Then a Muslim king was a friend of the Jews and said, "I will build here a temple, and none but Jews shall pray therein." He built the temple of marble stone, a beautiful structure consisting of red, green, and variegated marble. Petachia was a pilgrim. He had gone to Jerusalem. This was early. It was still when, in 1186, he happened to have gone there before Saladin reconquered. But he met a Rabbi Abraham there. And Rabbi Abraham apparently told him this story about the story I've told you about Kav and explaining where the temple should be built. He knew about this. So obviously, if Rabbi Abraham knew about it, any other Jews who were still there under the Crusaders knew about him. Then, after 1186, after Saladin had reconquered, a great number of Jews from Europe came back to Jerusalem after 1187, when there was the reconquest by the Muslims of over the Crusaders. A Spanish poet, Yehuda Hanarizi, was one of these Jews who came back, and he composed a poem in the early part of the 13th century on the city of Jerusalem after the Crusaders left. The poem is in the form of a dialogue, and I'm going to read it to you in a high voice and a low voice, so you'll see. "And how long have the Jews lived anew in this capital since the Muslims have conquered it? And why was it that they did not live here during the Christian domination, since those latters accused us of being deicide, of having crucified their God? They have not left off persecuting and stoning us when they found us. Tell me the circumstances under which our people were able to return here. God, jealous of the glory of his name and having compassion on his people, decided that the sanctuary would no longer rest in the hands of the sons of Esau, the Christians, and that the sons of Jacob, the Jews, would not always be excluded from it. Thus, in the year 1190 CE, God aroused the spirit of the prince of the Ishmaelites, Saladin, a prudent and courageous man, who came with his entire armies, besieged Jerusalem, took it, and had it proclaimed throughout the country that he would receive and accept the entire race of the Jews, the Ephraim, wherever they came from." So this is the way that after this Crusaders had reconquered in 1187, and in the 13th century, that a Jewish poet saw Saladin's reconquest of this place, and then the building of this temple, basically, for the Jews, in a way, as a commemorative. So, these rabbis who came, these pilgrims and rabbis who came, looked at the temple in this, the Dome of the Rock, in this positive way, as being linked to these positive attitudes. And this rabbi Pataki, and this rabbi Meshulam of Butera, who was a contemporary of whoever actually executed this image, and Rabbi Obadiah, they were both late 15th century rabbis, I've jumped to them, because they saw this temple in a similar way. For instance, I've got his Rabbi Meshulah's quote here. He says, every year when Jews go to their synagogue on the eve of Tisha B'Av, that's the commemoration of the destruction of the temple, all candles in the mosque go out of their own accord, and it is impossible to rekindle them. And the Arabs know when it is Tisha B'Av, and therefore they keep it as the Jews do. Isn't that interesting? That's a man who comes from the same place where this, northern Italy, where this was done. And there's another, this other rabbi, Obadiah, he also talks about, this in the past time, let's see, he alludes to this miracle of the candles. The miracle of the candles, that idea, that the candles on Tisha B'Av automatically just go out on the night when Tisha B'Av arrives. All of a sudden they all go out, and we don't know, nobody knows why this miracle of the candles occurred. Believe it or not, I found a text from 1927 or 32, it's hard to tell exactly, a letter that a visiting rabbi from the West had written. He went into a house in Jerusalem, and he wanted to watch and see if, on the night of Tisha B'Av, all the candles go out. And this is 1932, around 1930. And he looks, and believe it or not, all the candles go out on the night of Tisha B'Av. And he says, and a shiver went through me.
I guess so.
Now, of course, it's very probable that the Jews who were invited in by Amalek, by Umar, and then whom Amalek set to cleaning the, they were in charge of cleaning the candle holders, taking care of the wicks, and they also were in charge of cleaning out the cisterns. They did all, they were kind of attendants or servants. These Jewish families, 70 of them, in fact, they were hereditary families who continued to be in charge of these things that have to do with him. No doubt over the centuries, I mean, they must have converted to Islam, you know, and they, but they became this hereditary group. And whether or not that, I mean, this is just my 1930s quote, so I'm going to leave it. Who knows? Okay, so we know that Bernard von Breitenbach's city of Jerusalem. This is a huge map. He took a pilgrimage from Mainz to Jerusalem, and he had Ryrick accompany him, and Ryrick made sketches. And here is what they saw in the late 1400s also. And on this, you probably can't see it too, but it says Templum Solomonis. It says the Temple of Solomon here. So that came back. This became an extremely popular map. It was a printed source. It went all over. That Dome of the Rock now is in this printed source called the Temple of Solomon. Now, Agustiniani is a Christian printer who, since Jews could not have printing presses themselves, they weren't allowed to do that, he had the actual printing press, but he printed Jewish books. And so this became, this is the Hebrew printer's mark, then the Agustiniani Venice printed book, for instance, here in the middle of the 16th century, we have the Dome of the Rock shown in this book, and the way it's annotated here, as you can see, it's from Haggai, the Haggai text that I talked about briefly before, and it says, it quotes this part, "The glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former one, said the Lord of hosts." Now, in the Haggai text, it's probably referring to the Zerubbabel temple, built between the Solomonic temple and the Herodian temple. However, the Jews of this area would have known that. Rashi, who comments on that, was well known to the Jews in this area. There had been a printed Rashi at this time. So the Jews knew that this didn't really refer to this, but referred to the Zerubbabel temple. But they used this. And one scholar, who's Ruch Sadar, an art historian, gave me the hypothesis. I read from him this hypothesis that this became, for the Jews, the messianic vision of the temple of the end of time. And he has a very convincing article about that. And so I started to look at the art history that would relate to this idea of this being the messianic temple of the end of time. Well, as a bookmark, kind of, and as an emblem, this is also on the title page of the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides. The dome of the rock here is labeled Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the house of the Lord. But then, an even more interesting for me example, way down here in this Venice Haggadah from the early part of the 17th century, we have at the bottom an image from this Haggadah. That I'm going to explain in detail, but I want to tell you first that this last page of this Haggadah has the song on it, Ad Yirhu, God is great, may he rebuild his house quickly in our days. Okay? May he rebuild his house quickly in our days. And the scene at the bottom of this Venice Haggadah, and other Haggadahs, but this one in particular is very interesting, is this is the prophet Elijah with the shofar ringing the Messiah into, at the end of days, the messianic vision of the end of time. And in this messianic vision, what's so fascinating is that the temple is the image of the dome of the rock. Now, this is not supposed to, it's a dome of the rock within the city of Jerusalem. And if you, and now I'm going to go into an iconological, not just an iconographical study of, you know, but what's the deeper meaning of this, to my mind. There aren't just 12 houses here for the 12 tribes of Israel. There happens to be 15, but you might count one or more or less, but about 15. If you look at the people who are being ingathered here, you can see very clearly that some of them are black with turbans on. They have different kinds of hats. They have different kinds of breeches. They are indeed different. They are people not just from, you know, amongst the Jews, but from amongst all the people. And I want to quote here the part before the Haggai quote and the part, other parts around that Haggai quote, that this new house will be greater than the lesser one. And that Haggai seems to fulfill the promise of what's associated with this emblematic temple, Haggai. And they shall come with the precious things of all generations here to the temple. And I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord. So the notion in the Haggai text of this messianic temple of the end of time is that all of the nations shall come and participate in this end of time. And in fact, in this Venice Haggadah, these southern Haggadahs do not have the texts that the northern Ashkenazi Haggadahs have, which are very vitriolic against Christians. These are much more, these Sephardic southern Haggadah are much more opening and welcoming to all people. That's probably because they have not suffered in the Sephardic world the way they had, particular ways they had suffered. The Ashkenazi Haggadahs pour out their wrath upon the nations that know thee not, and upon the kingdoms that call not upon thy name. Here, in the Venice Haggadah, this text here, the Adir Hu, what's written, we have that, it's sung actually at the end of the Seder, the first one of which is tonight. Mighty he will build the temple soon, speedily, speedily in our days, soon. Oh God, build the temple soon. So the words of the Adir Hu and the imagery used to illustrate at the bottom of the page point, in my mind, to a messianic hope for a building of the temple at the end of time that will receive all nations, a site for great ingathering, and, as promised to Haggai by the Lord, that the Lord would grant peace. Now, it's not an isolated example. We have this wonderful one, Kirchmeier, in 1864, the Trieste Haggadah. Well, we can't tell if this is meant to be. It's in the 19th century style. It's not as though we're, is this meant to be, probably meant to be, the Messiah coming in, because it's in the same general place as before. We have, obviously, the same general Jerusalem here. We have the houses of Jerusalem. We have the open gate of Jerusalem. We have a peaceful, beautiful countryside. We have people walking freely in and out. The messianic vision of the end of time. And what is the temple but the dome of the rock?
Thanks.